What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks. Here on Law and Disorder, I am your host, Kat Brooks. An Ebola outbreak is ravaging the Congo and making its way into Uganda. Our guest today is Maurice Carney, co-founder and executive director of the Friends of the Congo. Good morning, Maurice.
Good morning, Kai. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right, my brother. Thank you for coming back on the show. How are you today?
I'm doing well, as well as can be expected, considering the circumstances that are unfolding in the country.
I always say that. I say I have the most amazing people on the show, and I never get to talk to them about anything pleasant. But let's get into it. We're going to spend the hour on the Congo this morning and what is happening. Talk to us. We're going to start with Ebola, and then I want to get into, because Ebola doesn't mean that the violence has stopped. Ebola doesn't mean that all the other things that have been happening aren't happening anymore. But let's start with the outbreak. What do you know about what's happening on the ground? How quickly and how widespread is this strain of Ebola?
It's interesting that you say that, Kat, that Ebola doesn't mean that the conflict is has stopped, right? And the head of the World Health Organization, WHO, issued a statement today, and he said that Eastern DRC, this is a quote, Eastern DRC now faces a catastrophic collision of disease and conflict with the Ebola outbreak in Ituri province. So the outbreak of the Ebola, where there are over 900 cases reported, over 200 deaths suspected by the World Health Organization and the Congolese government in the east of the Congo, as you said, in the Ituri province, that is ravaging the population. It's a strain of Ebola, according to the World Health Organization, the Bundibugyo strain, that doesn't have any vaccine or treatment. And at this stage, it represents the third largest outbreak in the history of the 17 cases of Ebola that the world has witnessed since 1976. So it's a devastating situation for the people of Eastern Congo, and really the region, because even the World Health Organization put out an international emergency saying that 10 countries are at risk. And we know the Congo, being located in the heart of the African continent, bordered by 9 countries. No other country on the continent has that many countries bordering it. So when anything happens there, good or bad, positive or negative, it has an effect on the continent as a whole.
And the last time you were on, we talked about where the Congo is situated, and I believe referred to it as the heart of the continent. And that, like, if we could do right there in the Congo, right, that right would spread across not just the continent but the globe, quite frankly. So same with current conditions, right?
Yes,
spreading across the continent and impacting the globe. I mean, we saw Canada just banned any flights coming in from the Congo, and I imagine other countries are going to follow suit, no?
Well, I mean, the United States itself was up front, as you could.
Rolling my eyes for my listeners on the air.
They're banning folks from Africa before Ebola, right? So yeah. They're just doubling down, you know, no one from.
Except for the detainees that they've illegally sent to the Congo. Now,
my goodness. Imagine that, right? That folks who sought asylum in the United States rounded up and sent to the Congo, where they don't speak the language. It's just devastating. And in fact, the fact that that President Trump could send detainees to the Congo gives you a sense of the climate in which the Congolese people are operating. They're operating in a climate where they're under the leadership of a neocolonial elite that responds, right, to the beck and call of those global elites, those that are in the core, let's say, right? And they see their salvation there. You know, the President Tshisekedi and the political elite in the Congo, they figure if they get the support of the United States, in this case, Donald Trump in particular, then they can do as they wish in the country, where they can continue to plunder Congo's resources, provide access to Congo's riches to the billionaire class, the likes of the Bill Gates and the Jeff Bezos and the Michael Bloombergs, all of whom have investment right around where the Ebola breakout in the east of the Congo. So it gives you a sense of the lay of the land in that, and this is really important, that in looking at this Ebola crisis, we would be remiss if we didn't look at it within the context of the colonial legacy of the Congo and the current neocolonial setup, right? That is to say, we're talking about a country that's spectacularly wealthy, estimated $24 trillion worth of mineral wealth there, minerals that are vital to major industries in the West, whether we're talking about the auto industry, we're talking about the electronics industry, we're talking about the aerospace industry, the tech industry, artificial intelligence, green energy transition. You being in California, you're with Gavin Newsom and his 2030 plan, you're quite familiar with that. So it's key to all of these sectors. So it is a country that is being plundered, where the priority on the political leadership and those on the outside is access to those minerals. And as history would have it, as revealed, access to those minerals at the expense of the Congolese people, right? 10 million perish 1885 to 1908 in the pursuit of rubber. At least 6 million have perished 1996 to the present in the pursuit of the coltan and the cobalt and the copper, all those minerals that power these industries. So it's within this context that Congo's institutions have been weakened and eviscerated to the point where, if there is a Ebola that appears, there isn't the requisite infrastructure, right, in order to adequately address it. Even though Congolese are the experts at addressing Ebola, but because of a dilapidated health system, because of a vacuous leadership that doesn't prioritize the interests of the people, then the people are left to the ravages of Ebola, left to the ravages of militia groups. Right, so the Congolese people are the victims of both natural and human factors. So it's really important for us to understand, because when we, you know, I've observed just trying to engage people around this, you know, health crisis, they turn their head away. You know, they're like, okay, that's what happens in the Congo. No, that's what happens in a space that's been plundered. Right, where we as individuals are secondary, you know, beneficiaries. We have our cell phones and, you know, laptops and their devices
Hybrid cars, energy
because
cars.
Congolese people are left to to deal with the crises and health epidemics like Ebola.
You talked about the billionaire class that have investments in the Congo. Yesterday, I'm directing a show right now, and it's called Going to St. Ives, and it takes place in sort of a fictional place on the continent. We've chosen to set it in the Congo so that we can have real today conversations about what's happening that nobody wants to talk about. So anyway, yesterday we were in rehearsal and I was talking about that I was going to talk to you this morning, and one of my actresses, Dr. Adeline Nzinga, said being in a place where there's not an appropriate response to a medical crisis because it's easier to allow disease to wipe out population that are in the way of profit. And so I just wanted to say that to you, right? And this is like the context we're creating for this play, but taken from what it looks like we're witnessing in real time on the ground.
Without doubt. And I would complement that by saying, right, that not only easier, but the priority are the minerals, not the people, right? So I give you an example. Recently, the Congolese government announced a $100 million deal where the United Arab Emirates, right, and the United States, that's what they said. The United States wound up denying it, but I don't doubt it. So they're gonna put together $100 million to stand up a militia of 20,000, right? Now, you know what the militia is being stood up for in the Congo, according to the Congolese government? To protect the mines, right? Stand up a militia to protect the mines. So the priority is to get access to those riches. And in order to get access to those riches, you have to displace the people because the people live on the land. The minerals are in the land. And you have to displace the people in order to get access to those resources. And then promises that are made to them, they say, okay, you can get housing, you may get education, you're going to get some kind of return. But invariably, they don't get any, I mean, they just don't get any of that. Right? So as a result of this hyper-extractivism, we say the people suffer from the three Ds, really. They suffer from destruction, right? There's a destruction of the environment where they live, so they cannot, properly farm and, develop any kind of food security. There's displacement, they're moved out of the way on the where the gold is or where the copper is, or where the coltan is, where the cobalt is. And then death, right? Death from conflict, death from disease, right? Death from toxic minerals or that toxic dust that they're breathing in, right? So these three Ds, the death, the displacement, the destruction, are part and parcel of this mad scramble for these resources on the part of this billionaire class that we talk about. So in essence, they're sacrificed, right? The people are disposable. Congo, as a country, the size of Western Europe, is one big patch of sacrifice zone in the heart of the African continent, right? And that fulcrum that could power the continent. So it is so, and it's not just that brings to the fore that it's not just a Congolese question, right? It's a question for Africans, people of African ancestry, Africans at home, Africans abroad, and for the world at large, because it's really a scar in the conscience of humanity that here it is, you have 6 million people who have perished in the last 15 or 20 plus years, and yet now they have to deal not only with a conflict, but with one of the largest Ebola outbreaks in history.
I may be tugging on a thread that you just sort of brought up, or this may be a totally different thread, because I don't know if this is part of the deal between the UAE and US to stand up the militia. One of the things that I sort of, after we spoke last time, I went around hollering about was the deal between the Congolese government and the United States to take over the mines, to extract the minerals, and to your point, displace the people. And so I wanted to ask you for an update on that. Like, has that rolled out? What have we seen? What has impact on the ground been for folks that risk their lives to go into those mines and get those minerals to eke out some semblance of a living? And now I think what you told me last time is that all of that is US property now, cutting them
Well,
off from said extraction.
it's moved at advanced at warp speed. And the United States, since December 4th, has not hesitated to invest or dole out the resources to pursue those minerals. And it's really a part of a larger project on the part of the Trump administration. In November of 2025, the Trump administration issued its a national security advisory and didn't give much space to Africa, a paragraph or so. An outgrowth of that is what the administration calls America First in Africa, right? America First in Africa that prioritizes the pursuit of critical minerals in order to secure the United States' critical mineral supply chain that would ostensibly power the Department of War, the war sector, as the Trump administration now rightly names it. and also the commercial sector, right? And Africa is priority for that pursuit. And within Africa, Congo is number one, right? Following the signing of the agreement, a strategic partnership agreement between the Congo and the Democratic Republic of Congo and the United States, the United States has an investment arm, right? It has several investment arms, but one in particular called the International Finance Development Corporation. It's something that Donald Trump occurred under the Trump administration in 2019. And it's responsible for investing on behalf of the US government overseas. And they had set out a letter of interest for $1 billion to pursue minerals in the Congo, another $1.8 billion that they're working with Orion, private corporation, in order to pursue minerals in the Congo. So what we see is this aggressive pursuit of the United States for to secure its supply chain in the name of national security. And it's not just the pursuit of these critical minerals, but in pursuing these critical minerals, they also engage in a geostrategic battle with China, where they seek to contain China. So with the Congo being the largest producer of cobalt, indispensable to the military sector, vital to green energy transition, artificial intelligence, just anything that deals with batteries. Congo being the second largest producer of copper in the world, behind Chile, it's probably even more critical than cobalt. Congo having spectacular reserves of coltan, it's vital to the aerospace and military industry. And then, of course, lithium, troves of lithium that has been discovered that, cobalt metals there in the Bay Area in Berkeley is pursuing. They've raised $1 billion to pursue those minerals. So it's the machinery is fully underway. Congo's already agreed to ship $100 million worth of copper to the United States as a result of a deal that as a result of the agreement. Because in the agreement, the United States, in its effort to contain China, United States, the agreement says that the United States can invest in minority stake in existing deals that the Congo has with other companies or countries. And they have an existing deal with China where they'll have 20%. So 20% of that copper deal that can go to the US. And then you have former intelligence officers and CIA operatives who recently acquired a part of a concession for one of the major mining companies called Glencore, that it's a you recently developed established U.S. company that's made up of these officials. So you have the United States taking the lead in terms of its public investment arm, and then you have the corporations following. Now on the ground, the Congolese are responding. Group of Congolese lawyers, the civil society, they've brought suit, in the constitutional court, saying that the deal is violates Congo's constitution, and the Congolese constitutional court is dragging its feet. In fact, the constitutional court told the lawyers that part of the reason why they've been slow to responding is that they haven't gotten a response from the U.S. Embassy, because they've been consulting the U.S. Embassy to be a part of this. Suit that's been brought against them by Congolese citizens. And you have people who are in the mining areas in the south of the country that are where you find a lot of small scale and alternative miners. They've been protesting and resisting because they see billions of dollars going out from where they live in their villages, and they lack electricity, proper drinking water, proper housing, proper roads and infrastructure, healthcare, education. So they are standing up and resisting. So what we see, Kat, is this collision of forces, the international finance capital, billionaire class, the local elites who are collecting rent, all working against the interests of the masses of the Congolese, which the World Bank says in a recent report that 80% of the 110 million Congolese inhabitants live on less than $3 a day. 80% live on less than $3 a day in a country that economists say has got $24 trillion worth of wealth. A country where the billionaires, those who've become billionaires in the country, are outsiders, the likes of Dan Gertler, an Israeli billionaire, or Ivanhoe Mines, the leader of Ivanhoe Mines is a billionaire, and making billions are being made off of the Congo. So it's very tragic. But the Congolese people, when we talk about, you mentioned earlier that there's sad stories, tragic stories, but the inspiring story, Kat, is that Congolese people are resisting, they're organizing, they're movement building. And I'm hoping Samuel can get on with us today. I've been communicating with him on WhatsApp, and he says, he said the electricity is out, right? Less than 2 out of 10 people in the Congo have access to electricity, and when they do get access, it's intermittent. I haven't been to the Congo where the electricity hasn't gone out. I've not been there where the electricity hasn't gone out. In a country that's reputed to have the hydro capacity to provide electricity for the entire African continent. So it gives you a sense of how challenging things are. But the inspiration that we draw is from the people who are on the front lines, like the Samuel Yagasi, who we're supposed to have on from Gova and the Basanja Coalition, who is just struggling just to get on because there's no electricity right now.
And if we don't have him on today, we will have him on next time. I promise you.
Please,
You may
that would be.
remember. I promise you last time that we are going to do consistent coverage on the Congo while we're talking about the United States and billionaire classes and extraction. While they're extracting wealth and minerals and breath and bodies from the Congo, they're also ha are directly impacting the amount of the kinds of relief that the Congo can find during this current outbreak. Can you talk about the collision with this outbreak with the removal of US aid from the equation?
I've seen a number of experts, make the argument that with the cutting of U.S. aid, that has severely hampered not solely the relief efforts, right, but it had already destabilized and the existing infrastructure because the aid wasn't going into not only the relief agencies, but also certain government agencies. I was listening to an interview by the head of Infectious Disease Center in the Congo. His name is Dr. Muyembe. He's the one who discovered the Ebola virus in 1976 and developed. Worked to develop one of the first vaccines for it. And he was saying that just to give a sense of the lack of engagement on the part of government, he said that the government, his own government, they pay the staff, but the health ministry doesn't fund his division that's responsible for managing and containing infectious diseases in the country. He said it's the US that funds it. So it gives you a sense of the importance of that aid, even though that's not the full answer for the people to be living. A country as rich as the Congo in natural wealth shouldn't be depending on U.S. aid for its health sector or anything really. But that's the reality that we're facing right now, right? That's the reality that's in front of us. And without a doubt, the cutting of USAID have some scholars have argued have caused tremendous loss of life in the Congo in the face of this recent outbreak of the Ebola virus.
We are speaking to Mark Maurice Carney, co-founder and executive director of the Friends of the Congo. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, and this is Law and Disorder. There have been reports, Maurice, of folks burning down tents where there are suspected or confirmed cases of Ebola, going into hospitals, gunfire inside of hospitals, demanding their kin, right, that have died of Ebola. Those bodies are not being given over because bodies that have died because of Ebola are highly contagious. But there's mistrust, of course, of the information that is coming from government about this, and there are burial rites and rituals that are being denied that are important to the people. And this is my own editorial, right? When you're in a time of crisis and you have very little to hold on to, your rituals, your culture, right, is one of the things that sustains you. So I'm wondering if you can talk about those incidents, what's happening, what are the burial rites that are being denied, and what is a better way of being in conversation with the people about this current moment?
Thank you so much for that question. It is so critical because we often see analyses that put the blame on African culture for the virus being exacerbated or the inability to contain the virus. The blame is put on African culture. I'm going to read a quote that was tweeted by the UN. United Nations. And the quote, it says, the UN says that every emergency, every epidemic begins in a community and ends in a community. It goes on to say, as Ebola spreads in Eastern DR Congo and Uganda, the World Health Organization says public trust and community-led action are key to stopping transmission of the rare Bundibugyo strain. Public trust and community-led action. So what does that say? It says that the community is at the center of staunching the spread of the virus. And we work with the Basanja Coalition. They're a coalition of organizations throughout the Congo. And we were mobilizing support for the Basanja Coalition. And critical to the work of the Basanja Coalition and its allies is that they've been there in the community, and the community trusts them. So when they educate them and educate folks in the community and say, well, you know, this is not a mysterious disease, this is real, right? It's not a mysterious virus, it's real. When they're bringing the hand washing machines, they're bringing the gloves, they're bringing the soap, right? They're bringing the materials that can protect the community. So the key is not castigating the culture, as you rightly stated, that you know, people have the rituals, and when people make transition, that's an important part of that. Moving from the realm of the living into the realm of, to the ancestral realm. So it takes people who are sensitive to that culture, who are present to that culture, to engage their community in a way that they can protect them, right? So that's the big challenge right now that the Basanja Coalition and their allies are facing, serving as a bridge between the community members and the state officials in a way that can build and sustain trust. So there are certain incidents that took place, and what that says to us is just that there's a breakdown of trust, breakdown of communication. So it says to the health officials, to the international NGOs, it says to the provincial leaders that that have to be prioritized, that trust, prioritize the building of relations within the community. We have a Substack, people can check it out at congofriends.substack, where we have a collection of journalists throughout the country who are writing on what's happening in this area. And the latest Substack article that was published talked about how the provincial leadership in Ituri province, where the epicenter breakout, is alienated from the population. That is, they're not serving the interests of the population, and how an intervention is needed in or at this is particularly this juncture in order for the provincial political leadership and the community to be on the same page. So you have local organizations like the Basanja Coalition who are working to make that happen. But the sensitivity around the respect for the culture, respect for the mores, respect for the heritage of the people is vital, to combating the virus.
When we're talking about, I'm just going to circle back on this a little bit. When we're talking about the rituals, is it immediate burial? Is it like what are the specific rituals that are being denied folks?
Well, it is immediate burial, but it's also, what the health officials do, and it's not even so much a question with immediate burial, is that when they recognize a case, they take it and separate it from the community, right? Where they don't allow the community to go in and take the body and take it back, to the ancestral location. For burial, probably something that people can relate to. When the Belgians they assassinated Patrice Lumumba in cahoots with the U.S. and the CIA,
Yes.
and the only remaining part of Patrice Lumumba was a tooth, right? That the a Belgian soldier that chopped up his body and dumped it into acid had that kept for many for decades. So. In speaking to Lumumba's daughter, Juliana Lumumba, which we've spoken to her on a number of occasions, and she was explaining to us, she's from the Tetela people. She was explaining to us, she's like, as long as we haven't been able to give our father a true burial, right? Then his spirit is unsettled. It's in motion. It's not settled. So for us, getting that tooth back is not a question of justice, but it's a question of respecting the ancestral heritage and process where we can take that and now we can bury that tooth. We have it back. We can do a proper ceremony around it, and his spirit can be settled. So that explains that that's a model of how people see their family members. That's why you may have seen some of the videos where people went and snatched the body of their loved ones and put it on a motorbike and are riding the motorbike back to the village so that they can get a proper burial. So there has to be some mitigation between protecting the community overall and also respecting the ancestral rituals, which are fundamental to the people. These are rural people, rural Congolese, who are steeped in their ancestry and their culture. So that is vital for that to be acknowledged and recognized and be mitigated.
We are also talking about this Ebola outbreak within the context, as we've said, of ongoing violence, which weighs heavily on medical infrastructure, hospitals, doctors, nurses, etc. Can you talk about that collision, an already overtaxed medical infrastructure that now is dealing with an influx of illness and death?
Yeah, it's really fascinating. We had a discussion last week with one of the reporters on the front lines, and we were talking about the not solely the violence, but also the occupation, right? Because of the invasion and occupation of large swaths of Eastern Congo, invasion by Rwanda and Rwandan soldiers in occupation with a group called the M23, you have large areas of Eastern Congo where the government is not in control, right? It's the militia groups that are in control. And I think there's been one case identified of an outbreak identified in the area that's controlled by the militia. So what is, and it's really fascinating to follow, what has been happening is that you have intermediaries, right? You have the World Health Organization, International Red Cross, International Rescue Committee. So they serve, and of course the United Nations, they serve as intermediaries between those who are in the occupied territories and the Congolese government. And through that network, They're able to get supplies. They're able to get resources to people who are in need. Not totally, though. I'll give you an example. One area that's occupied in the North Kivu province, a city called Goma, a population of 2 million people, the airport has been shut down. So humanitarian aid has not been able to get in to the airport, flown in order to, to provide support to the population. So there is an attempt, continued attempt to put pressure on the militia group on Rwanda to open up the humanitarian corridor so that aid can get in. They haven't done so to, to date. So in addition to that, Kat, when you talk about occupation, occupation comes from militia groups, Rwandan soldiers going from village to village, capturing territory. And in doing that, they displace the population. The population flee, right? So you in the area, in Uvira, in that area, you have about 200,000 people who are internally displaced. In the Congo itself, there are about 7 million people who are internally displaced. So you have these internally displaced populations that are currently are constantly on the move, which first you have to keep up with them, you have to track them, and then try to intervene. So the conflict, those are some of the other ways in which the conflict make really addressing the or staunching the spread of the virus incredibly, incredibly difficult.
As you were talking, I was thinking about, the theory of the survival programs of the Black Panther Party, which were right. If folks can't address their basic needs, food, shelter, illness, etc., they cannot struggle for their liberation, or focus, right? Because they're so distracted by the crisis and the folks in the Congo have been in crisis for so long. We have about 4 minutes, so I'm trying to think about where I want to go next. I'm toggling between
Well, no, go ahead. Well, what you shared, you just by virtue of what you said,
Oh,
sharing
yeah, go
about the
ahead.
Black Panther and survival, right? It's so important for people to understand that the first defenders, right? The first responders are the people themselves, the local communities. The local communities, when you talk about Black Panther and talk, Black Panther Party, you're talking about food, you're talking about shelter, you're talking about, just healthcare. The local population, organized locally, they're the first responders. You don't see it in the news, right? But they're the ones who are on the front lines, neighbor to neighbor, caring, and not only in terms of the material needs, but also the psychosocial needs, because people are traumatized. It's a conflict environment, a virus that is catastrophic and run amok. So it is that local population that are the first responders delivering care to their fellow brothers, sisters, mamas, you name it. So that's why, we're mobilized. When we educate people and share with people, we're mobilizing support for those local responders on the front lines in the Congo. That's why we say to people, go to freecongo.org, go to freecongo.org, support the relief efforts that are being led by local frontline organizers, and they're being led whether they get any resources or not. They're finding a way, making a way out of no way in order to support the fellow members of their community. So it's certainly in the spirit of the principles of the Black Panther Party that you evoked, and you evoked it at the right time because we want to leave on that high note that people are resisting, organizing, and supporting their fellow Congolese. Are you on mute? I think you may be on mute.
Of course I am, because five years of doing it online and I haven't figured that out yet. I was just gonna say yes, ending on a high note, and I'll just go on to say, right, we know, those of us that are students of history, that the party had a footprint on the continent, and there was regular communication. And then my brother, Chairman Fred Hampton Jr., just was in Ghana opening a Black Panther Party Cubs embassy there, and reestablishing some of that
No, and there's
connection.
a remarkable movie out. I don't want to take us too far about the Black Panther Party in Congo, Congo Brazzaville. right across the river that we had screened a while back at the Congo in Harlem that we do each year. But the Black Panther Party was, of course, Congo Brazzaville and Algeria, the first headquarters of Black Panther Party internationally,
That's
was
right.
on the continent in Algeria.
That's right. All right, Maurice, we have run out of time yet again too quickly. Thank you so much for joining
Thank
me
you,
this
Kat.
morning, and
Thank
thank
you
you for
so
your work.
much.
I'll talk to you soon, yes?
All right, be
All
well.
right, you too, eh?
Okay.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We have been speaking to Maurice Carney, co-founder and executive director of the Friends of the Congo. You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.